Hello and welcome to They Might Be Mariners, Lookout Landing's prospects focused podcast. And folks, it is draft week. I'm so excited to be here talking about the MLB draft with you all.
It's draft week. It's baseball Christmas. Yay!
We made it to the baseball event, which maybe
you can't take this away from us, MLB.
Yeah.
Although you try. Well,
they've tried as much as they can.
You took 85% of it away, but
yeah. They've done as much as possible, but we've managed to hold on to five rounds of some very entertaining, you know, pure promise, and I'm very much looking forward to talking about this with Kate Prusser, managing editor of Lookout Landing.
Hello.
And staff writer, prospect expert Joe Doyle.
Hola.
And it's, I mean, it really is. It feels like it could be what we get this year for MLB. And I don't know if that makes it more exciting, sort of more saddening, but it definitely feels like whether it's just because we've been covering it more or not, but it feels like this is one of the more important drafts I've really been aware of, more high profile drafts. How does it feel for you guys?
Yes.
I think more than anything, it's high profile because there's nothing else going on.
yeah.
No, but I think you're right. From a local perspective, Seattle's picking high and Seattle's got a lot of picks, and so there's a lot of flexibility and fun that can be had, and all of those things combined make it a fun experience this year.
And I believe even before all of this COVID nonsense went down, we said this is the most important draft pretty much of DePoto's tenure, certainly.
Definitely.
Because of the position the team is in, you know, we've had a year of just god-awful baseball. Bless all of their hearts, but last year was rough to watch. The war leaders, we were just looking at that in the Slack, and I honestly cannot really place a bunch of them. I'm pretty sure one is Austin Nola. I feel like two might be Austin Nola.
It's very possible.
Made a mistake.
Yeah, no, not out of the question.
And also, Austin Nola was one of the war leaders on last year's team, so just take a minute, let that sink in.
I'm not going to let that sink in. I'm going to reject it and accept another notion.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We've been sitting with some uncomfortable and hard things lately, just in general, processing the world around us. I'm not going to add anything to that that is not necessarily, and certainly thinking about that is not necessary. But the point is, it was a bad year. We're positioned to, I guess, do this rebuild thing, and the timeline for it was supposed to be that they're supposed to be rounding into contention, not maybe this year, but next, and now that all kind of, there's even more pressure, I think, because we're not going to have a full season. It doesn't look like we're going to have anything with regards to a minor league season, so I don't know what they're going to do about developing those players. You can't have them sit at home and twiddle their thumbs. I mean, you can't have Jonathan Clase and Noel V. Marte sitting at home all year.
Yeah, so even if they're working out. I mean, we talked about this last week a bit in terms of, like, how does development occur? Like, yeah, you can have guys, like, physically get stronger. Like, you know, even in a lot of the draft prospects, we've seen that of, like, well, they weren't really able to play, but they were able to work out and get stronger and improve their, you know, skills generally. But, like, so many of these guys just need to play and face consistent top level competition.
I mean, there's a ceiling to how much they can. Getting stronger is great, but, like, you don't want Noel V. Marte to put on a lot of extra muscle mass, or he's not going to be able to play shortstop. Jonathan Clase has maxed out. He is a tiny house person. He has maxed out every available inch. Tanquito. Uh-huh. There's no more room for any more muscle to go without costing him his, you know, elite 80 grade speed. So it's just these guys have got to play. So That really complicates things. So, the draft is important this year, more so than it ever has been, I think, as far as like franchise defining. I guess what would you liken it to, like maybe 2010, 2011? 2009.
Yeah, 2009 was the last time they had three picks in the top 40. They had Ackley go 2, and then we had Nick Franklin at some point, like 31, and then I want to say it was Brad Miller. It might be wrong.
No, I believe it was one of the catchers. I believe it was what's-his-face who made it up for just a second.
Hicks? Alex Jackson?
No,
Hicks.
Steve Barron.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve Barron.
Oh, Stephen Barron, I believe. Stephen.
Yeah, but that was the last time they had this kind of money and this kind of access. And ooh, I don't know. Man. I mean, those guys didn't turn out to be stars by any means, but they both turned out to be big league. I mean, I wouldn't call the draft a success by any means, but could have been worse.
Yeah. No, I mean it will be. You know, they've had high picks. You know, they had a series of high picks in that sort of stretch and really, you know, missed on or did not, you know, really connect on any of them. And that obviously, I mean, that's been reiterated over and over again, but like they have a chance here, and who knows what the draft looks like next year. If there's no games, do they just roll over the same pick structure? Probably. I mean, but like it's likely that this was going to be the year, and next year were going to be the years where they had a chance at sort of some top talent in addition to getting some depth. The depth has been taken away because the league chose to only go 5 rounds, so they've got to get, you know, some impact instead. They have less of a chance at depth, than they have to get some impact at least.
Actually, ESPN just had a story about the draft order for next year. Daniel says the March agreement has something in it that says, in the event that each club plays less than 81 regular season games in 2020, the office of the commissioner shall have the right, after conferring in good faith with the MLBPA, which is a laughable statement at this point, to modify the draft order.
I don't know how you could justify anything other than this year's order.
Even if they play 50, you could do that. Like, there are games, that's something. If there's no season, I mean, I guess there must be some sort of precedent for it, but I can't think of it. I don't know what other leagues or what has been done in years where there were supposed to be a draft and instead there was not for how picks go. So
I don't know how you don't piss off a whole bunch of teams by being like, well, the Dodgers, had a .500 record, but we know that they're actually a better team than that, so we're still going to have them pick 28th or whatever.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous, I think. And it does, too, like, if some teams get off to a slow start, it really does increase the appeal of just tanking for a season. Because why? It doesn't matter anyway. Why not just get a good draft pick and, you know, not necessarily try your hardest.
I don't understand how the MLBPA has anything to do with setting up a draft order. That's weird to me.
Yeah, that, I mean,
what would they, what say would they have? I mean, player agents?
It is strange. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it's like, player agents.
You want to see Scott Borish push an agenda? I'll show you how he can push an agenda.
Well, Scott Boras is, I'm all for, at this point, all for fighting in favor of the players and getting them the best deal possible. So, we're already looking at a shortened 20-round draft for next year. So I just think they should keep the same draft order as this year if the season is going to be that short. I would I don't think that anything less than 80 games would provide a very good barometer. And I'm not even sure about 80 games. I'd like to see some studies about that. But anyway, it's complicated and we don't know. I assume the Mariners would still have a good pick in that scenario, because I don't see any way that the product they put on the field this year is is all that different from last year. I mean, we're still in developmental stages for a lot of these guys, and they're having that development taken from them right now. So it's, but will it be six? Like, will it be that prime? Who knows? So this draft remains very, very important.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, but that is a debate that we can be having, hopefully not having next summer, and this winter. So let's hone in on what's going to go down this week. So Wednesday we get the first round, which extends through the first 37 picks. And that will obviously have the first pick by the Mariners at sixth overall. And then on Thursday, we get the second through fifth rounds, which has five more picks for Seattle, starting at number 43 overall. So just to kick us off, I would love to hear from both of you your sort of ideal way that this draft breaks down for those first two picks for the Mariners. Joe, do you want to start us off for sort of the who makes sense and who you would be happiest seeing Seattle end up with?
I think with the sixth pick, I think a lot of people want to see Nick Gonzalez, and that's definitely the camp that I'm in. I don't think he's going to last that far. And the reason I say that is Nick Gonzalez is definitely being marketed and advertised right now as the most signable player in the top five. I mean, his number is low. So whoever wants him, whether that be Baltimore or Kansas City or, you know, I haven't seen Toronto connected to him, but if somebody wants to save money, I think Nick Gonzalez is probably going to go. But that, I mean, your question is who I would prefer. So Nick Gonzalez would be my pick at six. And then at 43, I'd like to see him get a college arm that is athletic and projectable. Any of the Florida kids, Chris McMahon, Bobby Miller from Louisville. I think Bobby Miller would probably be my pick from Louisville. Mm-hmm. So I'd go with those.
Do you think he's there at 43?
I don't think he's there. I don't think Chris McMahon is there. If there's a guy that I think will be there, that'd be Tommy Mace out of Florida. Mm-hmm. I think he'd be in a fun arm, 93, 94 from a three-quarter arm slot.
I can definitely imagine.
Yeah, I think he'd be a good arm. Or Jared Schuster, too. So, a college arm.
Fair enough. Kate, how about for you? Your ideal.
My ideal is for them to take my favorite player in the draft, Robert Hassel. Which will never, ever happen. So I've adjusted
we're doing what we think is going to happen next. So this can be that for you.
I've lowered those hopes to just hoping that the Angels don't draft him or no other AL West team, and I don't have to watch him in the AL West because he is my favorite player in the draft. I think he's going.
Angels
to
may not
power.
Know he exists if they're
if they
know,
don't have any
scouts
didn't
get
that's,
to him. So
that's true. That's a tough one for me. I really like him, and I really want a bat in this draft because they drafted nothing but college arms last year, and I'm getting concerned about the makeup of what we have. It's just arms as far as the eye can see, and nothing up the middle. So if Nick Gonzalez is there, that is my ideal scenario. If I cannot have my Robert Hassel dream, I really hope he is. I don't have like the rosiest outlook on life right now, so I don't think he will be. Just because it doesn't feel like the universe is being very nice right now. So I guess, like, assuming that he's gone, I'm hoping somehow Emerson Hancock makes it through. He would be my next in order of preference. I would still be pretty psyched about having him. I've made my feelings about Max Meyer clear. I'm less thrilled by him, but I am more thrilled by him than I am by the names behind him. I mean, so that would be my order of preference at six, would be Gonzalez and then Hancock and then Meyer. At 43, I mean, I feel like they're going to take another arm. Like, I think they're just going to take arms and arms and arms, because that's what this draft has, and that's what they like to draft. And I don't know, maybe they can trade some of those eventually. I hope Carmen Majinski falls. I don't know if he will. He seems a little forgotten. Definitely not having a full season hurt him, because he's had some injuries. He's not been on the radar as much as some of these other guys. So he could slip a little. And there are so many arms that, like, some of them have to slip, right? So I think he's a good candidate to do it, and I would really be thrilled with him at 43. I like Bryce Jarvis out of Duke, also at 43. He is big league bloodlines, blah, blah, blah. But also, he didn't go to the Cape this summer. Last summer. He went to Driveline and Cressy, which is another... Those are, like, kind of the two preeminent training places, right? We all know about Driveline. He gained 5 miles an hour on his fastball. So got a significant bump there, increased his physicality, because he's not, like, the biggest, most physical guy. So I like him. I think he is... I like his makeup, too. He's kind of a little bulldog on the mound. He plays with kind of a chip on his shoulder. I just like him. I don't know if he's going to be there or not, but if he is, I would be thrilled.
Yeah, I like that group. I like the breakdowns there. I think it would make a lot of sense to get.
But if we're talking about what I really want at 43, I really want Cole Tucker.
Yeah,
the prep shortstop. I don't think.
Would you
do
want
that.
Cole Tucker even if they took Nick Gonzalez?
You guys, it is Carson Tucker. You're
Carson
sorry,
Tucker.
Cole.
Carson Tucker.
I'll
I'm
take
so
Cole
sorry.
Tucker.
I'm thinking of Cole. Cole has had some good tweets lately, and it's been in my mind. And Carson is a very different personality. He's not like quite as outgoing, I think, but you know, maybe you could grow into that a little. Yes, Carson. I like Carson Tucker. Would I want him even if they took Gonzalez? No, probably not. Just because I think the availability of arms there. I mean, I would like to come out of this with a preeminent arm, and if someone like McMahon was on the board, which I don't think he will be, but I love McMahon, so. Yeah, there are a lot of guys out there I wouldn't want to pass up at 43 to take kind of a risk. I want that infield addressed at some point. Like, it really is stressing me out. So, I think that there's just so many arms you can't pass up a really if they've got the positional player taken care of, then.
And somebody's gonna fall. I mean, I've gone over this thing like. So many times, and there's just too many players to go in the top 40. Like, there's going to be good arms at 43.
There's too many players, and there will be teams that won't want to pay.
Yes, right. Yeah. Who do we think is gonna close the purse strings up here?
Oakland.
Yes.
I mean,
I think the Angels might.
I think Oakland and the Angels are both
shave a little off the top.
Which is, I mean, you know, sort of strange, but, well, Oakland, I mean, would be at the top of the list of teams you would expect wouldn't spend, unfortunately, but...
What do we think about Kansas City? Because they're kind of... They're where I think Gonzalez goes off the board. I'm worried they're going to take him. But they do have a history of taking prep players, and they don't seem to have a problem with paying people. In the draft, at least.
Right. Well, I mean, they're paying all their minor leaguers. And obviously, you know, that some of that is, you know, I mean, I could very much see them going for Veen as much as any team. And I think there's, I think a good thing that's been sort of written about is like teams that are heavily invested in the like, real estate around their parks and have like racked up a lot of debt because they are, you know, trying to essentially not only own their stadium but then own the area, you know, like what Atlanta has done, for instance, with, you know, and the Cardinals have done, sort of developing essentially this whole like area around their stadium that like is also funneling money back into the team, which is not inherently bad by any means, but it does mean that those ownership groups have a lot of debt they've taken on because they're like, well, we'll make money back. So I think there are teams that have done that. Teams like, this has been often noted, Seattle, Tampa, Kansas City, like, have not necessarily done that as much, either intentionally or just have been unable to do it. But as a result, there's not necessarily that present sort of lack of liquidity to get really fun, you know, some fun.
I do wonder, though, with the Mariners. I mean, the Mariners are looking at an empty space across the street from them in Pyramid, right? And an empty space to their left in Henry's. I mean, I wonder if they will, if they would consider doing something similar to that.
That would be really cool.
It'd be really cool. It would be so expensive.
Yeah. I mean, not at the, you know, this probably isn't the time, but, you know, probably happens at some point after that.
I doubt any restaurants / other companies are going to be rushing to run into those spaces, which is really sad. I mean, those were like, there were pretty limited options for hanging out pre or post game already. And
yeah.
Now the two major ones are gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Pyramid, I mean, it's a real shame. Because, I mean, you know, this is, you know, a little off, but like, that is something that, I don't know. I mean, I guess I was not, I would love to actually hear more about this from people who were sort of in Seattle and like, very like of drinking and going out age, not because like that has to be all of it, but just like of an age when the Mariners were good and when the Mariners were the big deal, like whether that was like a thing where they're like all the places around there were catering specifically to that, because so much of it now is the Seahawks, and rightfully so, because and the Sounders, you know, and it makes sense because those are the teams, one, that are good, and two, that are going to, you know, consistently draw and consistently be inspiring enthusiasm. And the Mariners could be that. And yep. I mean, for me, obviously, I don't particularly care if the Mariners are making a ton of money, but I do like it when people are enthusiastic about a thing I'm very enthusiastic about. And so that's the part that I like about it and would love to see, you know, back throughout the city again.
FX McRory's was, I mean, yeah. I was just a kid, but like when they were really good, I was not of drinking age, but I remember walking by as a kid going to the Kingdom because that's how old I am, and seeing FX McRory's just like full of people and laughing and the game and they all, and I just remember being like, oh, I can't wait until I'm old enough to do that too. And then sadness, but yeah, it was, I do think it's relevant just because to the conversation about the draft, like how much money do the Mariners have to spend and where else do we think they might be spending that money? Obviously, they're spending a lot of it too internally on making T-Mobile Park the pinkest, shiniest place. Oh, T-Mobile is going to come after me for calling it pink.
It's magenta. Magenta.
Magenta. Yeah, there's actually like an owl has showed up at my window with like a big banner.
With a knife.
A big magenta banner. Yes.
The magenta banner
sign in one hand, in one claw? Talon?
Talon, I believe.
And knife in the other one. But they spent a lot of money fixing up the stadium, right? Because they want to make it shiny and attract an all-star game. And, you know, that's all supposed to be happening at the same time as the team gets good again and Seattle baseball is on the map. And, you know, this all requires some pretty significant cash outlay, which might impact their draft strategy some, which, by the way, guys, you got to spend money to make money. So,
yeah, I'm hopeful that Seattle is going to be one of the more straight up teams. Obviously, who knows? But I think there's not an immediate reason to think that they would be, you know, doing particularly poorly. They have one of the lowest payrolls. They have one of the smallest sort of guaranteed future pay, future payrolls rather. So I think they're in a pretty like easy situation financially. And
that is
even
true.
Even without dipping into, you know, the personal wealth of a lot of the people in charge, which, you know, could likely support it. But,
and you know, I know we haven't seen them pay for free agents in the past, but like maybe if they just go all arms here, maybe
no.
They will get themselves a Francisco Lindor or something. To shore up that. I know. I'm dropping bait for you.
Mm-hmm.
No.
I
tried to get John to kidnap him as he
well,
was driving.
Yeah, we drove through Cleveland. Yeah.
Through Cleveland. I was like, he's very small, fit in the back of his car.
It's true. We had a bed back there already.
Let it be known, John is not a true patriot, not a true fan.
That's true.
Would
that's
not
true.
Kidnap Francisco Lindor for me. So.
Yeah, that's on me. I'll work on it. My ideal, I think, at number six would be Hancock, and I know that kind of goes against my long standing diatribe of build around position players. If Veen is there, yes, I would like Zach Veen. Thank you very much. But I would like to see, I think Gonzalez is great and I'd be very happy with Nick Gonzalez, but I have been just really impressed with Hancock. I like his repertoire quite a bit, and I think that is a monstrous sort of group of pitchers that they would have in the minors there. In that event, and I think that would free them up then for signing at 46 either someone just like Chase Davis or, you know, even if they wanted to go with Casey Martin or Carson Tucker, a number of options there where they can splash a little bit of money but still get a position player who could be a real impact player, especially one who could handle middle infield.
Casey Martin would be fun. We haven't given that enough attention, and it seems more and more like his name is falling out of the first round and possibly falling out of comp round A.
Yeah,
I mean,
Joe, just real quick, because I think we really have barely talked about him at all.
Maybe we talked
about him, but could you give us just a quick rundown on Casey Martin, the sort of feats and foibles there?
Since he's your boy.
He was. Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about just pure tools, you're looking at a top 10 pick. He's a 70 runner. He's got a 60 arm. He's got, you know, solid average to plus power, and he can play shortstop. He probably won't end up playing shortstop. He'll probably end up at either second base or in center field. But the biggest thing on Casey Martin is he has like 20 plate discipline. He'll swing at things above his head, he'll swing at things that bounce in the dirt, and there's no real rhyme or reason why he's swinging at these pitches. It's not like he's chasing. It's like he's guessing sometimes. And so I guess I would pose the question back to you guys. I know that you've been beating the drum on get us a position player that we can have fun and watch develop. Like, let's test the Mariners player development program and get a project. And I think Casey Martin is that project. So, Kate, I'll pose it to you. Would you be comfortable with him being that test guinea pig?
I'm worried because I agree with you. I think he's a guess hitter at times, and the plate discipline is so hard to teach. Like, maybe it's a vision thing. Maybe he just didn't get that developed well over time. But, you know, you're looking at somebody who's already older because he's a college player. You don't have a ton of time left to develop him before you want to get him out there. So I just, for me, that kind of plate discipline is a non-starter, because I just don't feel like he'd hit. And if you can't hit, it doesn't matter if you have huge power. Like, if you cannot hit the baseball because you are striking out, you will fail out of baseball. So
yeah, he's an ambush guy right now. And I do think that once you get to the next level and you get a healthy diet of breaking balls, there's got to be growth between now and his debut. But I mean, like John and I said, he's got some of the loudest tools in the draft.
I would rather take a guy who is a line drive hitter. I'm thinking, which one is it? Is it not Nick Lofton? One of the other, not Jordan Westberg, but the other one. Who's his partner?
Oh, Foscue?
Foscue, yeah. Foscue, I think, is tabbed as a guy who is, Justin Foscue is tabbed as a guy who is not exceptional power, right? But he can hit. And I would rather have them take a guy like that and try to develop power out of him. Or, you know, so maybe he's a gap-to-gap hitter. Maybe he's a line drive hitter. Maybe the ball doesn't go over the fence. Like, to me, I don't think that's such a big problem with an infielder.
Yeah, if the guy can play middle infield, then, you know, you're not necessarily needing to be concerned about that. I think that'd be fair. I think that the appeal for Martin is that, as Joe said, like, Joe didn't say this specifically, but in the sense of, like, tools being in the top 10, like, a properly actualized Casey Martin is one of the best players in this draft. And, you know, I don't know necessarily if the Mariners can properly get the most out of him. Cause you know, you look at his lines and it's like, these would be great numbers if he was in high A, but he was in, you know, he was at Arkansas, and you would love to see
he was
better
facing Hartford.
Yeah, you know, and it's, I mean, the power numbers for a shortstop are fantastic. The speed is spectacular. Like, it really is, like, if he can just get on base, you know, or make contact, it's going to be great. But, you know, and the Mariners don't have many of those guys. The Mariners have a fair number of, well, this guy's, you know, a bunch of 45 and 50 grade things across the board, and maybe they'll get enough out of him to be okay. And I think somewhat unfairly, I really would love to see that sort of, this guy is some 60s and 30s, and let's get those 30s up to 40s or 50s, and let the 60s shine.
It's just some things you can get from 30 to 60 with proper development. Mm. Do you think plate discipline is one of them?
It can be. I think it can be.
If it's mental.
I think I fully agree with you that it is much more difficult than power. Like, where like power or you know, sort of just general, like, you know, improved athleticism is more attainable than you know, than like fully changing an approach necessarily. But I think it's not like, as Joe said, like, if he's just going up there with a bad plan, you know, that's not easy to change. But if he's willing to recognize it, you can change a plan, and it will take time. It'll take years, but like, it'll take every guy, you know, pretty much years to get to whatever it is that they needed to improve. So if his thing is, well, he's more than fast enough, he can play somewhere defensively and a premium position at that, and when he makes contact, ball go far, like
I mean, it's a good swing. I mean,
yeah,
like,
his swing
like
doesn't
mechanically,
suck. It's just, yeah,
it's not bad. And he's really strong for, you know, 175, 180 pound
yeah.
guy.
And it's not like he's like selling out. Like, you know, it's not like he's like.
So that would be my only concern, right. though, is if he is tapping into this power and this bat speed by selling out, if the only way to get him to, you know, a 40 approach is to reel his game power back to 40, then that's a, you know, then that's something that you have to weigh. Because if he's got 70 speed and a 70 arm and he's like a fringe average defender at shortstop, and then you dial it back and he's a 40 hit, 40 power guy, then all of a sudden it's like, well, I don't, you know, what's the upside here?
I think that's fair.
I assume that whoever drafts him has done some pretty significant work with talking to him and figuring out from a makeup standpoint if he is the kind of player that you can throw something like that at. Because not every player can handle, like, hey, you've been doing this wrong. This is a flaw that you have, and you have to fix it in order to get the most out of yourself. So,
Joe or and Kate, do you think he could be like Paul DeJong? Is it DeJong or DeJong?
I never
heard his name said out loud.
I think it's like, DeJong.
Is it DeJong?
But I don't think he can be.
You don't think so?
No, I think he's Jackie Bradley Jr. Like, I have a very strong fit comp on that. That's where I think he's going to be.
Interesting.
Like, I think he's going to run into like 12 to 15 home runs, mm-hmm. play a good defense, steal a bunch of bases, and strike out 32% of the time.
They really need to fix that baseball. Paul DeJong hit 30 homers last year. What the fuck? I've seen him swing.
He's I know, but he is like a... He just makes loud sounds off the bat. Like, he is... He is loud sounds, so...
He had exactly a 100 WRC plus last year with 30 homers. Like,
yeah, I actually really like that comp for Casey Martin. I think that that's a very... I think that's a very solid comp. And, okay. you know, is that a terrible outcome for 43? I don't think
I mean, no, that's an amazing outcome. It's like, just like, that's like a... You know, if it develops properly where it's like he's hitting like 230, 240, but like he's walking an okay amount. Like, you know, he's Zunino-ing, but at shortstop. You know, a lesser Zunino-ing where it's like, yeah, he strikes out a ton, but he, I mean, maybe even just like doing what Dylan Moore does, but like with more success.
Oh my god, I miss Dylan whining Moore, about Dylan Moore's unlikely power out of that tiny little body.
He swings so damn hard.
He does.
And having his sister like every single tweet.
That was one of my favorite things about 2019 is, oh, Dylan Moore hit a home. Oh my god, it went 440.
Yeah.
Why? Why can
so
he not
small.
Hit it out of the infield and then he blows it over the bullpen?
So small. I could not stop tweeting about it. And even though I knew that two things would happen, his sister would like it. I don't know if that was sarcastically or not. And then Mike Cameron would come and yell at me about it, which I was like, I'm not trying to
antagonize.
I'm not trying to say he sucks. I mean, he's just physically, you can look, I'm bigger than him. I stand taller and wider than Dylan Moore. I couldn't hit a ball 40 feet. Like, I mean, that's also because I'm a terrible athlete, but.
Your
John,
launch
you...
angle. I have seen you swing a softball
let's,
bat. And your
no,
launch,
let's
your,
not
your
talk
swing
about
plane
that.
Could use some work.
Let's not talk about that. John, you were talking about Emerson Hancock, and I want to dig in on Emerson Hancock a little bit.
Yeah,
because I agree with you. I think he is. I love him. I love the idea of him. I remember writing him up thinking there was no chance we could ever get him. And
right.
now there's like, I'm just seeing him slide, which is wild, seeing him get mocked to Seattle. But I mean, if I was to sit down and write up a bunch of qualities that I thought a frontline starter had, mm-hmm. Emerson Hancock matches all of those things. Mm-hmm. Why is he sliding, do we think?
So... Joe may have a different answer for me. I do think there is something to the critique on Hancock that if you watch him pitch, you're not necessarily going to, you could have three different scouts watch three different games of his, and none of them would know what his predominant out pitch was. Like, he has a pretty decent slider. He's got a pretty decent sort of curve slide, like a different angle kind of slider. And he's got a pretty good changeup, but it's like from game to game, he will go with different pitches. And it's not like any of them is like, oh yeah, that's Max Meyer's slider. Oh yeah, that's Reed Detmer's curveball. Like, oh yeah, that's Asa Lacy's sort of scowl. Like he has been immensely successful, but he is it's ridiculous to call a guy who throws like 94, 95 on average a sum of his parts guy, but like, he's definitely had a bit more like, I think, is this guy a modern pitcher, or is this guy the type of guy that would have had a lot of success a decade ago and for decades prior to that? And now when people hammer sinkers and you need to have a dominant breaking ball, does this work? And I think that that looks great for scouts, and then teams, what depending on what they're prioritizing, may or may not see that as the same for him. Joe, I don't know what, if there's something more that you think might be sort of making teams wary.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head with the whole one scout thinks one thing, the other scout thinks the other, and some of it might just be prospect fatigue. And I know he is not a prospect yet, but this guy's been like, he's been 1-1 on boards for 3-4 years, ever since getting to Georgia. So I think there's probably a little bit of prospect fatigue. There's always those floating rumors of health. Again, I have talked to people in that camp and outside of that camp, and I don't know where those are coming from. I still haven't seen anything like that.
Well, he had like a arm issue in 2019.
Yeah,
in 2019, but not, he didn't. Not
it wasn't an extended absence. And the velo never ticked down. And the track record has always been strong. Yeah, I mean, he had some bad innings in 2020. There's no denying that. But
he also wasn't horrific.
Right. It wasn't horrible. He wasn't walking batters. He was getting hit a little bit, and it happens. And I think that's been the biggest critique, is if this guy has a 60 fastball and he has a 60 changeup and he has a 55 slider and a curveball that he can throw every now and then, why does he give up 8 hits in 3 innings against like Stony Brook? You know, that's just been the narrative. And I haven't been able to nail down any sort of any reason specifically why Hancock is falling. I had a scout tell me last night that Emerson Hancock is Mark Appel all over again, because they've just got this huge ceiling, polish, reputation, but in reality, the sum of the parts is a very hittable package that never pans out. Which I don't think it's fair to compare anyone to Mark Appel, personally. That's a very, 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 very low bar. So yeah, I really don't have an answer other than I think it's just differing opinions.
I did just talk mad shit about Emerson Hancock after saying I really wanted the Mariners to pick him. So I do want to like clarify, like, the reason I think it works is, one, he's got really good command. I think the Mariners have obviously prioritized command guys. Mm-hmm. I think that a big criticism for Logan Gilbert was, well, he's got great command, he's got the frame, he's got all these things, he's got good velo, the velo dipped, but whatever. But, like, are his breaking balls, you know, does he have the off-speed pitch? And the Mariners were able to sort of work with him, tweak and improve his slider and his curveball to the point where he has thus far absolutely obliterated. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, fully like knockout stuff. And it's not to say like, oh, so of course they'll be able to do that with Hancock, but like the features that Hancock already has are extremely impressive. And I think whether it comes by, okay, we're going to adjust, you know, sort of we want you to sort of try and work on adjusting the release on your fastball so you get a little more backspin instead of sink, or okay, let's you know, what if you worked on, you know, this sort of angle and grip on your slider while you release, or whatever that might be. I mean, this is where I'm very much on the benefit of the doubt thing, where it's like, I don't want the Mariners to take someone like Max Meyer if Nick Gonzalez is there. Not because there's anything wrong with Max Meyer, but because like Max Meyer's doing the things that you would hope Max Meyer's doing already. Emerson Hancock has all these incredible characteristics that the Mariners weren't really able to get to talent-wise from a player. And they have the opportunity now, and they can, I think, maximize off of that based on their track record. And I think that's something worth trusting in there.
I do think, like, scouting the makeup is important, because you mentioned Logan Gilbert. I mean, the Mariners took a player who, even if he didn't know it, he was designed to be a Mariner. Like, he was a business analytics major at Stetson. He was already super analytical minded. He was already working with Rob Marcello Jr., who's now in the organization as a pitching coach. Like, he clearly fit their philosophies and was willing to sit down, pore over the data, make those changes. I mean, he's a student of the game, and I have not heard that about Hancock. I mean, maybe it's just that so much of the focus has been on what he brings to the mound and not necessarily what he brings off of it. I'm very curious about who he is as a person, what kind of person he is. Because if they don't think that they can maximize those things out of him just from a makeup standpoint, I don't think they would take him. I could see them too backing him off a little bit, you know, because he has been throwing, he can get up to 98, 99 even on the fastball. The Mariners have been a team that will back players off of some velocity. They did that with Gilbert. They didn't want him throwing 95. They backed him down to like 92, 93 so he could work on shapes and he could work on tunneling and,
I know exactly what you're saying, but when you say like work on shapes and tunnels, it does very much sound like okay, we're doing some elementary school stuff here.
Yes.
Baseball is a very funny game.
Yes. So he can work on, I saw Pitching Ninja has a pretty cool side by side of his fastball and his slider, and you can see there's a lot of tunneling there. Like the pitch comes out of the same place. I think that the slider has good deception. But I'm sure they could improve those things even. And maybe if they took off a little of the velo and had him focus, he's already got the command, as you said. So yeah, there's a lot of good building blocks there. I just think the ceiling is so high for him. He is a true like front of the rotation type, Casey Mize ish, like that SEC. I mean, maybe that's just falling in love with an archetype or something, but the Mariners just haven't had that in this current, you know, since the big three or whatever. So it would be really exciting to have.
So I'm gonna hop over to some of our listener questions here, because we got a few of them, and I appreciate folks for reaching out. One of the things, actually, from William Lofton at WLoft96 on Twitter was very much related to Hancock. And I think we've gone over it a bit, but like it really is fascinating. The question was essentially, what do you think of this? And screenshotting a scouting report on him that has him to the Mariners, but is, you know, really essentially calling his neither of his sliders much good.
And also pointing out that he has a head whack, which...
Yes. And so...
He does, kind of.
In concert with, as Joe mentioned, the Mark Appel comp, I mean, is there something about Hancock in particular that would make you more wary than, I don't know, just another start, you know, any top two, top three pitching prospect from years past or that? Or is it just sort of, as Joe said, prospect fatigue?
So with Hancock, in regards to him being a top two or three prospect in any other draft or in like top 100 prospect rankings?
Just in terms of like how, is there something inherently troublesome about him as a top pitching prospect that is, you know, you don't usually see all of the flaws in a top pitching prospect, you know, highlighted in a guy who you would think who is being projected as a top five, top six pick.
Well, I mean, I would make the argument that Asa Lacy has the same head knock that Emerson Hancock does. And I'll go a step further. Hancock has shown over the last 3 years to have, I mean, if we're going back to 2019, far superior command than Asa Lacy. So I think it just, like we had said, I think it just kind of goes back to evaluator's taste and the arsenal of pitches that a guy has. I mean, I would argue that Emerson Hancock has a better changeup than he does a slider or a curveball, and he elected to go fastball and breaking ball most of this year instead of employing the changeup. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of just what's your flavor, and if he's not, you know, for you, then he's not for you. It's the exact same thing that people say with, you know, with Max Meyer. Like, you're splitting hairs when you're talking about Meyer and Hancock, but Meyer is 6 feet tall and he throws 100 miles an hour, and there's head knock on his delivery too. And watched quite a bit of footage of Meyer speaking about how he addresses you know, his arsenal and facing batters, and he is not data driven at all. It comes from a natural ability that he just kind of picked up over time and in growth, and he's not worried about Rapsodo, and he's not worried about weighted balls, and he's not worried about, you know, what people are doing. So
yeah, he said on MLB Network the other day, quote, "I'm not a mechanical kind of guy."
Which, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's another example.
I'm trying really hard to like him, but he's making it so hard.
It really just depends on who you talk to, and if you're speaking in terms of Keith Law, maybe he has scouts out there that he trusts over others. I mean, Keith Law hasn't done any... This is not me attacking Keith Law. Let me just put that out there. But Keith Law has not done any scouting, as he's admitted, in like 15 years. So, I mean, he's trusting sources that he trusts, and everyone trusts other sources that they trust. It's just part of the industry.
I mean, I don't know that scouting report on Hancock makes it sound like he, and we can embed that into the articles, podcast articles, so people can see it. It makes it sound like he has been, but also it makes it sound like you saw him once during this past year where he wasn't, you know, admittedly very good. And I think there's, as far as prospect fatigue goes, like, it is amazing to me that his short stretch of like not very good baseball or seemingly ineffective baseball at the beginning of this year, it really seems to like cloud over all the stuff he did last year. Like, he was very, 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 very good last year, everybody. We're forgetting this.
It was 97 strikeouts to 18 walks in 90 and a third innings last year.
I mean,
and 58 hits. Like, it was just very dominant performance in, a 1.99 ERA. Again, like...
In the SEC.
In the SEC, yeah. Like, yeah. And especially for the Mariners, who have, in theory, pushed to put a lot of emphasis on, let's have a really solid defense. Like, let's have really good infield defense here. Getting a guy who gets a fair number of ground balls, it's not the worst thing in the world. Like, yeah, I think
it's important to not overlook the fact that there are cultural fits, right? And honestly, when Max Meyer said, like, oh, I'm not a big mechanics guy, I mean, the Mariners are very into letting players be themselves, and so if that's what works for him, that's what works for him. They certainly don't demand that everybody be on the analytics train, but it did kind of give me pause a little bit about, like, oh, is he going to fit in really well to a club that's pretty highly analytical and really, really prides doing mechanical analyses? Is he going to fit in well with, like, the Logan Gilberts and the guys who sit around and talk pitching craft? Like, maybe not, and maybe that's fine. I think that there are things that we don't even know. Like, I do not think the Mariners would draft Asa Lacy even if he was available to them. I do not think he's a good cultural fit for the club, just because of some things that he said on Twitter, and just that's been wiped now. But I'm like, I really, really, really would be surprised if you brought that particular player into this particular clubhouse. So there are other things like that too that we aren't totally aware of, or the general public isn't aware of. So when you see surprises happen in drafts, like, oh my gosh, they took that guy? Like, that guy was way down. You know, it might just be that this club really believes that they can work with this particular player.
So building somewhat off that last bit, we did get a question from Scott Judy on Twitter @moves_like_Judy. Who do we need to make a voodoo doll of to make sure we get Asa Lacy? And I wanted to fold that into just a something I wanted to ask you about, the both of yous, which is, is there really any situation in which Seattle could land one of the top three guys in this draft? Let's go to another question here. I appreciate we got a couple good questions about Nick Gonzalez, Max Meyer, which obviously we've talked a fair bit about here. We've got a question here from Patrick Dubuque, @Ekibud, on Twitter. Very, very timely question, which is, why didn't the Mariners sign Tony Phillips? I will confess, I did not realize that the Mariners drafted Tony Phillips in the 16th round of the 1977 draft. Although, if they failed to sign him, so that he then was taken 10th overall a year later by the Montreal Expos. Do either of you have a compelling reason as to why the Mariners failed to sign a guy who went on to have an 18-year career worth about 50 wins above replacement in the 16th round? It seems like they should have done that.
Who was the owner of the team at the time?
The original owner? That's a great, great question.
I wrote this up years ago. I should know. I think it was like the used car salesman guy, right?
Oh, was it Danny Kay?
No, he's a good guy. Danny Kay. He's done a ton. Look up Danny Kay sometime if you haven't. Film actor. He's in, I want to say it's White Christmas, maybe one of the classic holiday movies.
It is White Christmas. You're absolutely correct.
He has a long history of, like, donating to and leading charitable causes. He's a really good guy. I was very surprised to find out he was part owner of the Mariners. But then there was the bad guy who didn't spend Euros? Any money. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe he was later. I believe
He starts in 81. So yeah. I unfortunately don't have any good reasoning behind that. So I'm just going to say it was the 70s. A lot of shit went down.
Yeah. Tony Phillips, who was born and, well, not born, but raised and went to Roswell High School in Roswell, Georgia, chose not to go to the Mariners and instead went to the New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell, New Mexico. So he may have had to complete an exchange program of some sort between the Roswells, or maybe the New Mexico Military Institute had really just like a great lunch, school lunch program, and he just did not want to miss out on that.
Maybe he really likes aliens.
That's true. That's true. Was that, that could very well be it.
It was extraterrestrial. Why it didn't happen?
Okay. Let's. We got just a couple more questions here. We got a couple actually from PDUT at PDUT on Twitter, and I guess one of the chances the Mariners go wild card in the first couple picks and try to max out value with the other four? In that sense, I think just going maybe for someone like Jordan Walker, not necessarily that he'll drop, but going for a really high profile prep in the second pick that they would have to go well over slot for. Do you think there's a chance of that? Do you think that's likely? Would you want them to do that?
I think that the team is in such a situation that they need this draft to go well that I don't think they can afford it. Like
they need to get multiple potential.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like impact players. If you're going to suggest maybe they go, it depends on how big of a wild card you're talking about. Because like, say Seattle goes Heston Kerstad because they're familiar with him and they could probably get him for, you know, $750,000, $800,000 under slot. Like that wouldn't. I mean, it would shock the hell out of me, but. Also, like, that's about as far down the draft board as I think they would go. I mean, I'm always going to advocate for Mick Abel, but he's not going to be cheap either.
Yeah, I don't see them doing anything, unfortunately, other than taking two college arms with the first two picks. I mean, Scott Hunter basically said as much in a story by Shannon Dreyer about the draft. It's,
yeah.
A direct quote. So, I mean, I think surprises always happen, but I would not look for them to do anything other than two college arms. And maybe there's a prep in the compensation round that they can maybe funnel some extra money towards. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be anyone who's like high profile, though. It's not going to be, I mean, I don't even know if it would be like a Carson Tucker. Yeah. Almost said Cole again.
I mean, one other thing to point out, and I've said this on like most podcasts, but the fact that Seattle is going, I mean, they're almost certainly going college with their sixth pick. They're going to save money on that pick. Like, they're going to save like 300 or 400 grand on that pick. It doesn't matter who it is. I think that's a pretty good lock. And then if they go college again at 43... and they save, you know, a couple hundred thousand there, that gives them a lot of money to work with at 64, like 1.8 million, 1.9 million. So like they're still in a very, very good position to make a big splash at 64. They can get like basically anybody that they want that would still reasonably be on the board at that point.
Yeah. I think that's it's a good framework, especially because, well, and feeding into another question we have here of, like, do we think some teams are not going to utilize their full draft pool and that other teams might be, who are more willing to spend, could capitalize? Seattle has six picks. I mean, they have more picks than most of the teams in the draft, and there are going to be guys there who are much better talent-wise than the slot that they're, you know, available still to be picked at, so... I agree with you guys. As much as I would love to see them go real big on some of the preps, especially in the second round, like there are going to be guys worth spending a little bit extra for later on that I think they'll be really happy with instead of going way over for one guy necessarily. You know, and Maybe that works, maybe it doesn't, but you know, you spread your risk around and you spread the opportunity around. I think that's what Seattle would be best served doing.
Yeah. Don't sacrifice any picks this year. That would be my biggest piece of advice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's finish it up here. We got a question from Ben Thoen, at Ben_Thoen on Twitter, longtime staff prospect writer himself. And Ben asks for a best case scenario and a worst case scenario / who we would be upset about for the first couple picks. I don't know if there's anyone really jumps off the board for either of you guys, but let's start with worst case scenario, and then we can finish on a cheery note for best case. Who would you be just like a reasonable possibility that you would be really upset with? Or not even upset. I mean, you know, because like I think we said it a previous time, like they're all pretty good options at number one, but like the worst case scenario in plausibility.
Like there's so many guys on the board that Seattle could take, and I genuinely think like everyone that has been mocked to Seattle is still like at worst. If you're going by the whole like A through F grading scale, like I think at worst Seattle would have like a B or a B+ pick. And I'm not gonna like throw out any names, but because I just don't think there's a bad pick. I think there's a lot of ceiling with whatever direction they go.
I would be disappointed by Reed Demers, who I've seen mocked to us a couple times. Not because I think he is a bad player in any way. I mean, in other years, I'd be thrilled to have him, but you know, I'm not super stoked about College Arm, even though I know that that's the direction that makes the most sense to go in. I just think, like, with the looking back one day and looking at them having taken Reed Detmers over, like, Zach Veen might sting at some point. So it's just, I think opportunity, I would like them to make the most out of this opportunity, and I don't know that that pick, as far as names I've heard linked, is making the most out of that opportunity. Max Meyer, I'm not unenthused by. I mean, I think he's pretty fun. My only concern with him is I worry that they get him into the system, the team takes an upswing, they start doing better, and they switch Meyer over. Edwin Diaz him, basically. They switch him over to a reliever and have him be a closer, which is still good. I mean, a dominant major league closer would be fantastic, but again, I wonder about that opportunity at number six and who's going to have the most value out of this draft when we look at it 5 and 10 years down the road. And I think there's a lot of good names here, and I would just really like them to maximize the value in it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know. I would rather have Gierstead than Detmers, you know, in that like sort of breakdown of it. And I mean, it's unfair to Detmers, right? It's, you know, if they were picking at 10, Detmers is great. It's just at 6, you know, you want to get someone who feels like they have a shot at being a star, and that's. It's a longer route to stardom for a guy who throws in the low 90s and has a out pitch that is, you know, is a slow breaking curve, which often is a pitch that doesn't hold up as well against better competition. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's a tough swing there. Beyond that, I mean, I've said I think my over-under is 1.5 on preps that they take. I would be pretty disappointed if Seattle ends up taking no, you know,
prep. Which is very I feel like that's a very plausible scenario. They take absolutely no preps because there's the numbers that they've attached themselves to are just too big, so.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, a big part of this is, you know, there wasn't a season for so many of these guys, so we don't know how certain guys have developed. We don't know, like, what the team has been keeping tabs on, who the team has been keeping tabs on more accurately. So, I mean, that makes it a real challenge. But, yeah, I mean, it would feel, if we don't come out of this with one or, I would say two position players who feel like they have a chance to, you know, be big league contributors, I would be disappointed. Even as there's a lot of great pitching here, I think that that's something that the team really is in need of organizationally. So we'll see. Joe, did we get your sort of whole worst case sort of sentiments there, or was there more there?
Yeah, no, I you guys kind of covered it. I don't think there's a bad pick. I would be less enthused by Reed Detmers just because, like you said, he doesn't have the high octane like ace stuff in his arm, and I think what you said about him too is I'm not totally sold on the curveball either, whether or not it's like, is it a solid average pitch plus pitch, or is it a plus pitch? Because like, yeah, Kershaw threw the same curveball, and Kershaw threw 96 and Kershaw threw a literal plus slider and a cutter, and Detmers doesn't have all that. So I would be less enthused by Detmers, but I don't know if I'm in a position to like doubt the Mariners front office after the last few drafts. They've done a good job.
Yeah, I get down. I think last year was a downer draft just because it was such a weak draft, and maybe I think they did the best they could with it, but it was so heavy on arms, and I'm really unenthused overall about the prospect of going in here and getting a bunch more arms because I don't want the system to develop like Detroit's.
Right.
I would like more balance there. And they're not huge players on the international. If they do it this way, then I want to see them go sign some really top flight guys internationally. And, you know, I'm excited about Christian Cardozo is the one we already have. What's his name?
Starlin Aguilar.
Yeah. I'm excited about him. He has, you know, I mean, he's already at third base, so it's a little concerning. But hopefully he can hold up there. But yeah, I want to see them spend some money, get some super fun players in that we can, it's kind of hard to get excited about pitching, you know, but I do look back at 2018 and I'm like, yeah, I mean, they're just not like, I imagine little kids growing up, you know, they're going to have a poster of Kelnick on their walls. They're going to have a poster of Julio on the walls. You don't really put a poster of Logan Gilbert up unless, you know. I love Logan Gilbert. I love him, but I think unless you are Mama Gilbert, you don't necessarily put a poster of him on the wall. So I'm trying to like toe the line between giving them a ton of credit for the 2018 draft, which wasn't just how they drafted, but also the trades that they made after it and what they wound up walking away with just in their talent pool from that, and hoping that, you know, okay, so maybe their specialty is fixing up arms and making the most out of them. So maybe they could take somebody like that, make a real good potential starter out of them, and then trade that for something else. So
that's the hope. All right, well, let's finish here. Joe, best case scenario.
I mean, best case scenario is definitely Nick Gonzalez for me. I would, like I kind of mentioned earlier, I don't know if it made it on the pod, but I would rather have Nick Gonzalez over Austin Martin because he's going to afford you the opportunity to get a bigger name later in the draft. And frankly, I think Nick Gonzalez is going to be a better hitter than Austin Martin, both in the hit department and in the power department. The only thing you're really sacrificing is athleticism. You know, maybe you're getting average speed rather than plus speed, but that's fine with me. So Nick Gonzalez would be my pick, and then, you know, go big at 64 or 43.
Kate?
Oh, Nick Gonzalez would absolutely be a dream. I mean, I think I love his talent. I love the bat, but he's exactly, again, my kind of, you know, I love me the pure hitters. But also I just think culturally he fits in really well. He's a guy who was not scouted at all out of high school. He had two offers, maybe just one actually, Austin P, whatever it is. I think that's in Tennessee. I don't know much about it. And then UNM, which I think maybe he started as a walk-on guy, didn't even have a scholarship initially. But anyway, he's always been a guy who's been like kind of below the radar, who's just worked his way up by clobbering the baseballs wherever he's gone. But I mean, even after his incredible year on the Cape, or summer on the Cape, Fangraphs still had like a fifth round tag on him. Like, oh, this kind of profile usually goes in the fourth or fifth round, which I think he's got an incredible work ethic, and I would, I'm doing exactly what I said I wasn't going to do. I'm getting attached to the idea of Nick Gonzalez as a Mariner, and it's going to end in heartbreak. But yeah, that would be, I don't even care what they do for the rest of the draft. If they got Nick Gonzalez at six, sign, sealed, delivered. That's a successful draft for me.
Okay, so. You really need the Orioles to take Asa Lacy or Austin Martin.
I do.
If both Veen and Nick Gonzalez are there at four, I think they're going to go Veen, and it gives you a shot. But if Veen is only there at four, then obviously both of our guys are gone. So,
yeah, it's the Mariners just straight up saying that they'd pass on Veen is a real, I mean, not straight up saying, but you know, that's pretty much what everyone says in the industry. So, and I'm trending back negative, even though I meant to be positive. I would love for the best case outcome would be that, Emerson Hancock would be a pretty close second best case outcome, although I don't know, they know so much more than we do. So if he's not the pick, then maybe there's probably a reason for it. I'd love for them to get one of the names that we've talked about later in the draft. Just a pitcher with a solid track record who feels like a good value at the slot. That would be my best case scenario, I think. I've given up the idea of like splashing huge on a prep with the second pick. I don't think it's going to happen. So,
yeah, I think I feel similarly. I think my ideal is Veen, but failing Veen, which I think is unlikely. I think I would want to see Hancock, and then either at 43 or 64, somewhere in there. Maybe even 78. I'd love to see the team go for one of the sort of toolsy infield preps. You know, you've got, you know, Colt Keith, you've got Kobe Mayo, you've got Drew Bowser, you've got
Bowser's pulled out.
Oh, that's right, Bowser pulled out. You know, Yoandy Morales, you've got Harold Cole, you've got, even Carson Tucker. I mean, just someone in that sort of framework where you've, you know, a player with the, you know, all the tools that the Mariners just need to help refine. I think that's the thing I would love to see. Someone to get excited about in that regard, to pair with someone who I think can make an immediate impact at the number six pick.
I'm really sad that with just five rounds, we're not going to get like an Adam Matko, you know, like somebody who's just wild, never heard of him, way different background than a traditional prospect. And, you know, I saw Matko on Instagram the other day, is throwing 95. I mean, it wasn't a ton of command on the 95, but it was 95, and he was like, you know, I don't even know if he's cracked a 200 yet. He's still
a little lefty.
Yeah, he's still got a ton of developing to do, just physical maturity wise. So I think I'm really gonna miss not having that, and I hope that somehow there is a guy who just kind of sneaks up on us out of nowhere and has got a cool backstory. And all what I really want out of this draft is somebody who, you know, as Julio kind of moves up the ranks, and as Jared, you know, somebody who I can really start to feel possessive about and proud of, like, that's mm-hmm. our guy. I'm really proud of our guy.
All right. Well, let's call it there. We are going to have quite the week. I think tomorrow tomorrow, which will be today, rather, if you go on when you're listening to this, go up on the site. We've had a couple draft previews in addition to, you know, weeks and months of draft previews and whatnot. Joe will have a lengthy write-up, mock draft, a whole bunch of stuff. Kate and I will probably have a few more things we'll lob in before draft day, and then obviously we'll have pick-by-pick coverage on the days themselves.
And an open thread.
And an open draft thread, itself. Yeah.
So a place to come talk hang, about it.
Come yeah. chat. We'll be in there, obviously.
And maybe like a quick pod recap after the draft.
Yes, most yeah, almost assuredly. Yeah,
talk we'll a little bit about what Seattle's got.
Mm-hmm. So lots to look forward to.
Big week.
Yeah, big week. Hopefully you guys are all out there doing okay.
Baseball Christmaka.
Yeah, baseball Christmaka, exactly. Until we talk to you again, be well. That being pretty universally Spencer Torkelson, Austin Martin, and Asa Lacy. I know there's been talk of like, well, maybe some team might try and save some money and go significantly under slot. That obviously still takes a lot of surprises to get to the Mariners at number six, but Is there a circumstance where that could happen that you guys could envision, and would you want that?
I definitely think there's a circumstance. I don't think there's a circumstance where Asa Lacy gets to the Mariners, but I do think there's a circumstance where Austin Martin gets to the Mariners, and we've seen it before. I mean, Kyle Lewis fell into the Mariners' lap, and nobody was expecting that to happen, and that was, what was that, pick 11? I mean, that was further down the list, so I think... you can chalk up Spencer Torkelson at one. If Baltimore goes with either Zach Veen or Nick Gonzalez, then that moves Miami into the driver's seat with Asa Lacy or Austin Martin. And I think they're pretty set on Asa Lacy in that scenario. And then the question really becomes, well, Austin Martin is a Boris guy. He's going to ask for a lot of money. He's going to ask for overslot at four or five. Does Kansas City spend that much and get Martin, or do they go and, you know, grab Nick Gonzalez if Baltimore takes Veen, or do they go after, you know, Veen, for example? I think if and I don't think Toronto, personally, I don't think Toronto would sign Austin Martin. That doesn't seem like their type of player right now, given where their organization is at. It's a pretty stacked
infield. Yeah,
I don't think that makes as much sense. So if Seattle is willing to pony up, like, this is going to be the thing. If Austin Martin does fall to six, Seattle's probably going to have to pay, like, $600,000 or $700,000 overslot, or definitely overslot in some capacity, and that's going to limit them moving forward. So
here is my hot take.
Yeah.
I'd rather have Nick Gonzalez than Austin Martin.
So would I. Because I think they're both second base. Yeah, I think they're both second basemen, and I think Nick Gonzalez has a better bat.
I like Gonzalez's bat. I like Gonzalez as a person better than Austin Martin, too. Just being honest. I think Nick Gonzalez is a good cultural fit for the Mariners. I'm trying not to think about it too much because I don't want to get my heart set on something and then subsequently have it broken, but...
Well, and another thing, Kate, you're really attached to grabbing, you know, a prep to root for. If you sign Austin Martin and Gonzalez is on the board, you could make a pretty good argument that you're throwing away the chance to sign a prep that you'd like.
Yeah.
If you take Austin Martin.
I think that based on Scott Hunter's comments, they're...